This is Rural Health Leadership Radio.
Episode 70, a conversation with Dr. Alan Jenkins, professor of economics at the University of Nebraska, Kearney.
It's clear that not much help is going to come out of Washington.
Welcome to the Rural Health Leadership Radio with your host, Dr. Bill Oxier. Each week, Dr. Oxier has a conversation with a different rural health leader to discuss what's working and what's not working in rural health, along with other topics of interest to rural health leaders. Rural Health Leadership Radio's goal is to improve health in rural America by providing a simple, no-cost means to share information and connect rural health leaders from around the country. And now, here's Dr. Oxier with today's guest.
Hi, everybody. I am your host, Dr. Bill Oxier, and welcome to this week's episode of Rural Health Leadership Radio. I would like to thank the Dynamic Leadership Academy for Rural Health for underwriting the cost of today's episode. But more importantly, I'd like to thank today's guest, Dr. Alan Jenkins, for taking time out of his busy schedule to join us today. Welcome to Rural Health Leadership Radio, Professor Jenkins.
Well, what an honor. I'm glad we ran into each other at the Nebraska Rural Health Association annual conference.
Yeah, so the pleasure is all mine because we're always looking for great guests for Rural Health Leadership Radio. So why don't you tell us who you are? Who is Professor Alan Jenkins?
Well, I'm not exactly a big city boy. I was born and raised in Blackwell, Oklahoma, small town about 60 miles south of Wichita, Kansas. Blackwell's famous. It's right on I-35, and it's the first McDonald's in Oklahoma as you drive from north to south.
So
sooner or later, everybody drives past Blackwell. So I got a BA from the University of Oklahoma in 1976, and then spent the next 5 years working for local governments at the city and county level. They went back to school and got a PhD from University of Nebraska at Lincoln. And since 1987, I've been on economics faculty at the University of Nebraska at Kearney. We serve a rural area of the state. So my areas of interest have always been in rural economic development, Platte River issues, and for the last 10 years, I've been increasingly interested in rural health care. A colleague and I did fairly substantial economic impact reports for the Medicaid expansion issue for both South Dakota and for Nebraska.
Great. That's quite the resume there. Then I believe in 2016, you received the President's Award from the Nebraska Rural Health Association, didn't you?
I did. I just enjoyed those people from the first time I went to one of their conferences. Very dedicated, hardworking. I saw an opportunity to increase the connections between our students and rural hospitals. So I went to our senior vice chancellor for academic affairs, made a pitch, and he threw in a little bit of money for internships. And so, in the summer of 2017, we had five University of Nebraska Kearney students who were doing summer internships in rural hospitals.
Excellent.
That's a real difference maker for the students. And also for the hospitals, so it's nice to get the little recognition that, you know, every once in a while, you know, it's a little bit like last night, you know, every once in a while there's a home run that, you know, gets hit.
That's right.
Has that game ended yet, or is it still going on? I went to sleep after about 11 hours of it. So yeah.
Well, thank you for sharing that about you and for the work you're doing in rural health. So the name of this program is Rural Health Leadership Radio. So what is your definition of leadership?
Well, I believe that leadership is that bundle of characteristics that include vision, charisma, honesty, communication skills, persistence, and resilience. And I suspect that true leadership is actually pretty uncommon. I also suspect that what is often perceived as leadership is a lightweight version of what Malcolm Gladwell was talking about in his book, The Outliers. You know, Gladwell looks at successful people and sort of, you know, looks for the pattern behind their success. And he sort of finds that, you know, you have to be smart enough, you have to have some opportunity, and there also has to be some slight advantage then that plays to your benefit. Now, that combination of being smart enough and having an opportunity and having some slight advantage, that's enough to get you into a leadership position. But a leadership position and true leadership are not the same. You know, there have been many generals, but how many true military leaders have we seen? There have been many presidents, but how many true leaders have we seen? So I think that in world healthcare, and actually all through our policy discussions now at every level of government, the leading edge of the baby boomers. Now, I was born in 1953, so I'm right in the middle. I'm the, you know, the pig in the python, as the demographers put it. But the leading edge of the baby boomers, they've pretty much made out like bandits their whole careers if they did not have to go to Vietnam, because they hit those first positions at a time when there was very little competition, because 500,000 people who should have been competing with them were busy in Southeast Asia. So I think that has, we paid a little bit of a price for that over the years. I like if you look at rock musicians, for example, you know, that whole first wave of successful rock musicians, they're all born within a couple of years of each other in the mid 40s. Then they occupy those niches for the next 20 years. So once the Rolling Stones are famous, it doesn't matter whether or not you can play the guitar better than Keith Richards, because that slot is filled. You know, how long did Leno and Letterman occupy those late night slots? So I think one of the reasons that we're kind of struggling a little bit right now, I'm gonna blame that leading edge, the baby boomers. They weren't really ready to occupy those leadership spots, and they've held them maybe a little longer than they should have. So I'll try to offend everybody out there with that statement.
Well, that's a very interesting observation. You're making me think about things perhaps a little differently here. So, but that's the great idea behind Rural Health Leadership Radio, is stimulating conversation. So thank you for contributing to that.
My father was a paratrooper in the 82nd Airborne, and I figured if he was brave enough to step out of an airplane in harm's way, I should be brave enough to maybe, you know, say something a little bit thought-provoking without worrying about whether or not, you know, there may be some consequences. So,
well said. Thank you. So you've got an interesting background. How did you come to focus on rural healthcare economics?
I came into economics. I came into my economics program having worked for city and county government. And what I found in that work experience, that at the end of the day, it was economics that drove every decision. And so when I went to graduate school, I chose economics because it seemed useful. And once I became a professor at the University of Nebraska-Kearney, I began to teach those classes that are more policy-oriented, like environmental economics and public finance. And then about 10 years ago, a former student who's actually been a guest on your program, Leslie Marsh, who's now the CEO at Lexington, we were talking, and she had my public finance class. And she said, you know, economics is going to push itself into healthcare here pretty quickly. And now, you know, normally when somebody gives me good advice, I don't take it. But in this case, it was exactly the right advice. So I created a healthcare economics class, and I started going to the World Health conferences. I started interacting with the CEOs and the staff members and people from the state agencies and from the associations. And so it was sort of a natural progression then. I don't really like to sit on the sidelines. I'd rather be engaged. And you know, there are times when it's very helpful to a group to have an academic on your side.
Right.
You know, I can say controversial things. I can help. And so I take it pretty seriously that, you know, the good taxpayers of Nebraska have been willing to provide me with a nice life, and I should do what I can to, you know, to help them. Again, don't get me wrong. I'm not Mother Teresa. You know, I'm not sitting here with a halo, but I do like to be involved. And this was a place where I thought that because of the basic geography of the University of Nebraska at Kearney, we're right in the middle of the state. We should have rural development as our university's hallmark. So
that makes sense. Thank you. So can you talk about the changing infrastructure of rural health?
Sure. You know, it's number one, it's clear that not much help is going to come out of Washington. You know, all of the proposed legislation, you know, any legislation that increases the number of uninsured and increases insurance costs for older and sicker people is bad news for rural health care. But it's also pretty clear that our rural legislators don't really care all that much. You know, so as in most of life, education is the key, but economics is the driver. So each rural community now must literally rally around their hospitals. Rural hospitals are critical infrastructure. They're the cornerstone of any kind of rural economic development. You can't possibly have a successful community if you don't have reasonable access to high quality health care. You know, rural communities, you need a paved highway, you need electricity, and you need access to health care. So it seems to me that the path forward here, as we're moving, you know, of course, at every level on policies, it's everything in healthcare now is about cost containment. But for rural residents, when you're thinking about, you know, consumer-based healthcare, we need our rural residents to be truly rational, not just focused on short-term costs. So, for example, I just bought a pickup. I traded in my 2004 pickup for a new one. Now, as I was shopping, was I interested in buying the cheapest possible pickup or the pickup that best met, that was going to best meet my needs for the next 12 to 15 years? Which one of those selection criteria did I use?
I'm guessing you picked the one that would serve you the best over the next 12 years or so.
Got that exactly right. And so consumers in rural areas, they have to think that same way. So, for example, if you need a scan and you could go to a freestanding imaging clinic and maybe get that scan for $100 less than the hospital would charge you. If you're thinking about just the short-term cost, well, again, a rational person would go get the cheaper scan. But when you buy something, you have to think about the full range of consequences. So you go buy that cheaper scan and all your friends stop going to the hospital for the services that could be provided from that rural hospital. And then the hospital closed. So now what happens to the value of your house, Bill, when the hospital closes?
It goes down.
It drops like a paralyzed falcon. What happens when you have a heart attack and you die because they can't get you to an open hospital within that golden hour? Was saving that $100, was that really a bargain?
No, not in those terms.
Not in those terms. So again, it's what, you know, education is the key here. You know, there've been all sorts of studies that show, you know, many, many consumers drive past the local hospital, you know, to a larger facility because they just inherently think that the quality is better at a bigger hospital. Multiple studies have shown that's simply not necessarily true.
Right.
There are a handful of actions that really can only take place in a bigger hospital. Obviously, you're not going to go to a critical access hospital for brain surgery.
Mm-hmm.
But again, all the evidence says the things that those rural hospitals do, they do very well. And that shouldn't surprise anybody. You know, in my small town, I was hurt once and had to go to the hospital, and the nurse who was my major nurse after that surgery, guess what? It was my best friend's mother, right, was my nurse. Mm-hmm. So you think she took care, you think she paid attention and took care of me? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, because so, you know, you have all those personal connections within a small community, and you know, those relationships don't drop away at the emergency room door.
No, thank you. So I would have a difference in the world.
Well, absolutely, absolutely. And so I have no trouble being an advocate for rural hospitals, because I would choose them anytime possible.
Well, what about the regulatory reforms that would benefit rural health?
You know, in that bundle of challenges in front of rural health right now, there certainly may be times when at the national level, there's simply not enough input from rural voices. So sometimes regulations, which make sense for larger places with more bureaucracy and more staff, that makes sense. But when you try to implement those in smaller hospitals, it ends up, the CEO of a rural hospital, you know, doesn't have five layers of helpers under them,
right?
You know, to do reports and so much of the quality landscape right now is really just sort of a bean counting mentality. You know, check a box. Did you give somebody aspirin within a certain amount of time? Check a box, you know. So, you know, it's just sort of a laundry list of things. And whether or not that actually improves healthcare, I think that's kind of sketchy at best. And as you get into smaller hospitals with fewer staff resources, it's a little bit like in education with the No Child Left Behind legislation, where if your teachers are spending all their time complying with the regulations, then how much time do they have for actual teaching? Mm-hmm. And if our nursing staffs and if our administrative staffs are spending all their time filling out reports, then are they really providing that leadership for the institution that the rural hospital needs?
Yeah, it's a dilemma at a minimum. You know, you brought up Leslie Marsh a little while ago. She has been a former guest here on Rural Health Leadership Radio. She is the CEO of Lexington Regional Health Center in Lexington, Nebraska. And I know her hospital just went through a major renovation. What impact does a renovation like that have on a community?
Well, there's obviously a direct economic benefit because, rural hospitals almost always use local vendors and suppliers as much as possible. Now, the actual design of a hospital, so that's a pretty specialized area. It's not very likely you're going to find an architect locally who's going to be able to meet all the requirements for hospital design. But once it comes time to actually be, you know, hammering nails in the boards, local hospitals have a long history of using local sources wherever possible. And, within economics, we talk about the multiplier effect, the idea that if you receive more income, then you will spend some part of that. And as you spend it, it becomes income for somebody else. So I think the Lexington remodeling, I think, was around a $25 million project. You know, it likely had somewhere in the neighborhood of a $40 million impact on the Lexington economic community.
Wow.
When all said and done.
That's a big impact on a small community like that.
I think Lexington has about 13,000 people. Once again, there were people who came not just from Lexington, but, you know, again, you know, electricians, plumbers, you know, those people, you know, they don't mind driving a little bit, you know, to a job site. So, just the, you know, construction is important, but just the ongoing operation of the hospital, again, requires all kinds of local inputs. And that's one of those areas where I think, again, rural hospitals can even do a little bit better job there. So, for example, in a lot of like school systems now, there's sort of a move toward local food procurement. Yes. So instead of only buying canned goods that, you know, were produced in California, you know, school districts now are starting to work with local growers to have more locally produced food. Well, rural hospitals, should be doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have people in the community that are growing tomatoes, you know, why buy them from California when you can buy them from your next door neighbor? So I think that is, I mean, once again, that's a little thing that by itself is not going to, change the bottom line very much for the hospital, but it does help build relationships between the hospital and the rest of the community.
Absolutely. And, you know, you add all those up, all those little things up, add up to big things.
Absolutely.
So in your opinion, what do rural health leaders need to do differently?
Once again, to say differently, that's always tough because, you know, like, you know, in Nebraska, there's 64 critical access hospitals. You know, every CEO is trying their best to make that hospital successful. And they're all pursuing slightly different plans. They don't all come together and say, you know, we're all going to do it exactly this same way. So maybe it's not so much that, you know, is there a way to do it better? I do think that through something like, for example, advertising, in Kearney, Nebraska, there's about a dozen critical access hospitals that are close enough to me that they advertise on the local TV station. And those ads are always, you know, pretty similar. Each one shows some nice, smiling, happy people, usually fairly attractive, saying, you know, come to my hospital, we'll take care of you. But when every hospital has exactly that same advertising message, then how effective is that message? And I think people understand that one anyway. I think one thing that rural hospitals can do is really start thinking of advertising as, here's our chance to provide direct information to our communities on how valuable we are to them. And also, here's some things you can do to improve your health. So instead of advertising as sort of just, like an ongoing open house, here's what our emergency room looks like. Advertising could be ratcheted up to become more informative and focus more on, you know, here's how important the hospital is. Think about that before you drive down the road, you know, to Lincoln for a procedure that could be done right here at home. So I think that's something, that's a place where hospitals could maybe do a little bit better job. And then the other thing they should be thinking about, because volume does matter. And if there are places in Nebraska that don't have very many people, and there are places, there are counties that are losing population. And in those cases, the leadership of the hospitals have to work on networking with other hospitals. And so there may have to be more formal networking that takes place over the next few years.
Interesting. That's always helpful to collaborate with others.
Yeah, I think it's going to be just absolutely critical. I don't think I think it's going to go beyond helpful to absolutely essential to network with others.
Yeah.
In a meaningful way, even to the point of sharing different specialties. Mm-hmm. So, you may have four or five critical access hospitals, and maybe only one of them does OBGYN, and everybody else ships those, you know, the pregnant women to that one place.
Sure.
And then everybody sort of gets a specialty. They sort of, you know, you can't just cherry pick and, you know, take the thing that makes you money and push everything else off to on your neighbors. It would require real collaboration, but that may be what it takes to get that necessary volume.
Interesting idea. So thank you for sharing that. So you've learned in the last 10 years, you've certainly been immersed in rural healthcare. to a great deal, studying it and studying the economic impact. What scares you the most about the future of rural health?
Well, we're awfully close to Halloween for what scares me most kind of question. My fear is that in this transition, rural voices will be ignored, and we may well have to have a retreat. With in Nebraska, we may not be able to keep 64 critical access hospitals. Again, as population changes and as the economics of healthcare change, we may not be able to keep all 64 open. But at least let's make sure that as we're changing access to facilities, we have some policies in place that make sure we end up with adequate service everywhere. And so that Gordon, Nebraska is a long ways from any place else. And so if the hospital at Gordon closes, that creates a huge gap in coverage. There are other places where there are three or four hospitals in a single county. And if one of those disappears, it may not have the same impact. So I would hope that at all levels that our decision makers do keep in mind that notion of a critical access, that there are policies in place that perhaps favor those hospitals that truly are isolated from any neighbors.
Well, that's what scares you the most about the future. What excites you the most about the future of rural health?
Well, I'm getting close to retirement.
So that's exciting to you.
Yeah, no, it's probably exciting to a lot of my students as well. But the thing that excites me, once again, and I'm reminded of this every time I go to the Nebraska Rural Health Association meetings, the most exciting thing about rural healthcare is the quality of the people who are in leadership positions. I've never met a more dedicated group than the folks who come to that rural health conference. So I think, at UNK, we are trying to help. So for example, we've now created a healthcare management minor. So the students take my healthcare economics class, and then they take a couple of management classes that are designed specifically for people who want to go into healthcare. And there's a rural bias, because of our location. So, sure. So the part that excites me is that we're going to be shipping young people out into the industry who are better prepared than people were 20 years ago.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. You're doing some great things there. So hard to believe how much quickly the time has gone by. We've covered a lot of territory in our conversation today. If our listeners only take one thing away from this conversation today, what should that be?
Education is the key and economics is the driver. You have to think about the economic consequences of everything you do.
Professor Alan Jenkins from the University of Nebraska Kearney, thank you again for joining us today.
Well, it was a real honor. I enjoyed this. I did all the talking. Imagine that. You got to talk to me.
That's okay. That's why we wanted you as a guest. So I want to thank you for sharing your thoughts, your observations, your experiences in rural health, and sharing your stories with us today. I want to thank all of you out there for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, please go to iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, whatever your favorite podcast app might be, and subscribe to Rural Health Leadership Radio. To continue the conversation on leadership in rural health, you can also join our LinkedIn group called Rural Health Leadership Radio. And if you're a Facebook type person, you can also visit our Facebook page, and we always appreciate your likes. So until next week, let's keep working to improve healthcare in rural America.
If you would like to connect with today's guest, please send an email with your contact information to bill@billoxier.com. If you would like to be a guest or suggest someone else as a guest, have a question you would like to ask, or simply want to contact Rural Health Leadership Radio, please use that same email address, bill@billoxier.com. That's bill@billauxier.com. You can also visit our website at www.rhlradio.com.
We'd ask that you please support our sponsor, the Dynamic Leadership Academy for Rural Health. The Dynamic Leadership Academy for Rural Health's mission is to improve rural health, one leader at a time.